Meanwhile, Felix and Thornton Brad Bradshaw, chairman of RCA, were friends and had been discussing RCA's strategic options. Brad had been brought in to fix RCA in mid-1981 after a successful run as the president of ARCO. He was quiet, self-effacing, and incredibly wise. I felt very good about him right away. Brad had done a good job and was particularly successful with NBC by enticing TV producer Grant Tinker to head up the network. From the start, Brad had no intention of staying all that long. Ironically, he found his replacement in Bob Frederick, who had been one of the GE executives in the race for Reg's job. Bob had joined RCA 3 years earlier as chief operating officer and president. He was made CEO in 1985. Brad remained as chairman but was having all kinds of second thoughts about whether RCA could make it on its own. Out of the blue, I got a call from Felix, who asked me if I'd like to meet with Brad. A few days later, on November 6th of 1985, we got together in Felix's New York apartment for drinks. Brad showed up dressed in a tux so he could skip out for a formal dinner. It was quickly clear that, like me, Bradshaw was worried about Asian competition. He was as focused on being number one or number two as I was. We never talked about a specific deal that night, but we found out we liked each other. Felix had been a good matchmaker. Brad and I were comfortable with each other and shared a common understanding for the strategic rationale behind a combination. Ours was a short meeting, a little less than an hour. When I left Felix's apartment, we hadn't scheduled a second meeting. At this point, we were just dating, but I felt that there was a real shot at marriage. The next day, I put together a team, including Dennis Dammerman, our chief financial officer, and Mike Carpenter, our head of business development, to dig through RCA. We worked on the project under the code name Island. The day before Thanksgiving, our team got together to decide whether to take the next step. For more than 4 hours, Larry Bossidy, the Island team, and I wallowed through all the pros and cons of the acquisition. For me, wallowing has always been a key part of how we ran GE. Get a group of people around a table, regardless of their rank, to wrestle with a particularly tough issue. Stew on it from every angle, flush out everyone's thinking, but don't come to an immediate conclusion. With RCA, we wallowed to the point of seeing that there was a lot more than just a broadcast network. We had a small semiconductor business, so did RCA. We had an aerospace division, so did RCA. We both were in the TV set business. Combining operations in these businesses would make each one of them a lot stronger. We had been in the TV station business for years, and our short courtship with CBS gave us enough understanding to become reasonably comfortable with the network. We put a $3.5 billion valuation on the broadcast business. If we could stomach paying about $2.5 billion for everything else, then the deal could be a home run. Our major concern was the valuation of NBC. Though its ratings were strong in 1985, cable television had started to eat into its network audience. We made some very aggressive assumptions on cable penetration and still decided that the deal was right. I kept asking, 10 years from now, would you rather be in appliances or in network television? We all agreed to go away and think it over during the long Thanksgiving Day weekend. We met again first thing Monday morning. All of us had come to the same conclusion. The numbers worked, and beyond the network, we saw that most of RCA's other businesses were a great fit with ours. It was a go. I let Felix know that at the right price, we were interested. He set up another meeting between Brad and me on Thursday, December 5th, in Brad's duplex at the Dorset Hotel in Midtown Manhattan. After some small talk, we quickly got to the point. I'd like to buy your company, I told him. Our companies are a perfect fit. The fit was obvious to him as well. I tried a price in the $61 a share range, more than $13 higher than RCA's stock was trading at that time. He paused, and in his professorial way let me know it wasn't quite enough. By the time I left, we agreed to pursue the deal and to disagree on a final price. The next day, things got a little hairy. It turned out that Brad hadn't discussed our meetings with Bob Frederick. When Bob found out, he became angry, to say the least. He felt the company was being sold out from under him. Bob and Brad had a brief falling out over this, and Bob tried to marshal some of the directors in RCA's board against the deal. When the board met on Sunday, December 8th, Brad was able to get a majority of the board to approve the deal. Afterward, he called me to report the good news but said the price still wasn't right. He had retained Felix to represent him. I needed an investment banker, so I signed up my good friend John Weinberg, who was running Goldman Sachs. Over the next few days, meeting at a suite in a New York hotel, Brad, Bob, and Felix negotiated with John and me. At the end, as usual, we got down to nickels and dimes. Brad was at $67 a share, and I was at $65. The deal closed when I gave Brad $66.50, probably 50 cents more than he expected. I always tried to leave some goodwill on the table when the seller's ongoing involvement was important to the company's success. By Wednesday evening, December 11th, we had a deal to buy RCA for a total of $6.3 billion in cash. There was an odd footnote to the deal. Only months before, in August, a lower-level lawyer at RCA had called one of our attorneys and said he would like to get rid of an old GE-RCA consent decree. During World War I, the U.S. government asked GE, AT&T, and Westinghouse to form the Radio Corporation of America for defense purposes. In 1933, the Justice Department decided that we should spin it off as a separate company. We did that and took over their headquarters building at 570 Lexington Avenue as compensation. However, the consent decree resulting from that transaction restricted GE from buying RCA common stock. The Justice Department eliminated the 50-plus year restriction by October, clearing the way for the deal 2 months later. Talk about dumb luck. None of us had a clue the consent decree existed. After wrapping up the deal that Wednesday night, I left RCA's lawyers' offices and went back to the GE building on Lexington Avenue to celebrate. It was the same building the company had gotten for its part of RCA in 1933. What a night! We broke out the champagne. We were laughing and giving each other high fives. All of us, Larry Bossidy, Mike Carpenter, Dennis Dammerman, and the others, were like kids. I'll never forget the kick we got looking out the windows through the fog and seeing the RCA sign illuminated on top of their building at Rockefeller Center. It was just 3 blocks away from ours. We could hardly wait to get the GE logo up there. We felt like hot stuff at the moment. From my first meeting with Bradshaw to final board approval, it had taken 36 days to nail down the largest non-oil merger at the time. The deal, announced December 12th, was a turning point for GE. The critics, and there were many, focused on GE getting into the network business. They asked, what in the world was a light bulb company doing buying a TV network? Broadcasting gave us pizzazz and great cash flow, and the hideaway I wanted from foreign competition. The hidden value would come in the less glamorous assets that got little attention. The RCA acquisition gave us a great network and a lot more strategic chips at the table. It also sparked a new, energized GE. We had been going through lots of turmoil with our restructuring and downsizing. The deal changed the atmosphere. I remember walking up to the stage for the opening session of our operating managers meeting in Boca that January, a few weeks after the acquisition was announced. All of a sudden, some 500 people in the room stood up in a spontaneous ovation. RCA became the kickstart to a new era. Once the deal closed, we sold RCA's non-strategic assets, including records, carpeting, and insurance. We didn't like the culture in the record business. The carpet business didn't fit with anything we did, and neither did a small insurance company. Within a year of the deal, we had $1.3 billion of our $6.3 billion back. I tried hard to keep Grant Tinker as head of NBC. With Brandon Tartikoff as his partner, the two of them had turned around the network with lots of great hits, from The Cosby Show to Cheers. Tinker had signed on for a 5-year stay that would be up in July. He had been commuting weekly between New York and California and was tired of it. Although Tinker told Brad before the acquisition that he intended to leave, I tried to convince him to stay with us. We had dinner in New York where I offered him what was for me a notion of money. There was nothing I could do to get him to reconsider. Fortunately, I had a backup plan from day one. Bob Wright was now running GE Capital after the sale of Housewares. He had been sent by us to Cox Broadcasting when I tried to buy it and stayed there 3 years as president of Cox Cable. Bob was the perfect fit. He had a real feel for the business, was familiar with GE, and was a close ally as we moved into strange territory. I appointed Bob head of NBC in August 1986. The media asked, "How could this GE guy run a network?" The long and short of it is that 15 years later, Bob is still there with a great track record. While we left NBC as a separate business, we immediately began to integrate the RCA and GE operations that complemented each other. We reduced overhead by putting joint teams together that met with me every week. The team's objective was 1 plus 1 equals 1. One GE and one RCA staff professional would equal 1 in the merged company. The integration teams agreed that the best from each company would get the jobs. This wasn't idle BS. GE got the top staff jobs, but in the complementary businesses, RCA won most of the big jobs. We ended up the number one U.S. TV set producer and put in an RCA executive to run it. We did the same with our combined aerospace and semiconductor businesses, with RCA leaders selected. Heading up a fourth business in government services and satellite communications was Gene Murphy from RCA, later to become head of GE's aerospace and aircraft engine business and eventually a GE vice chairman. Gene had a military bearing. He always delivered on his commitments. I considered him Mr. Integrity, as high a compliment as you could pay anyone. These assets, or chips, gave us strategic options that weren't possible before. Over the next decade, each of these chips would create real value for GE. Unfortunately, while I was doing the biggest deal of my professional career, the biggest merger in my personal life was ending. Carolyn and I had been having difficulty in our marriage for many years. Through all my GE years, I was the ultimate workaholic, while she did a great job raising our four kids. All of them were on their way and doing well. Catherine, our oldest, had graduated from Duke University and was in her first year at Harvard Business School. After getting an undergraduate degree from the University of Virginia, my oldest son, John, was getting his master's degree in chemical engineering at Illinois. Our other daughter, Anne, graduated from Brown University and was going to the Harvard School of Architecture for her master's degree. Our youngest son, Mark, was in his freshman year at the University of Vermont. Carolyn and I simply found ourselves on different paths. Other than our friendship and mutual respect, we had little in common. It was difficult and painful, but we divorced amicably after 28 years of marriage in April 1987. Carolyn went to law school, got her law degree, and eventually married her undergraduate sweetheart, who is also a lawyer. Suddenly, I found myself single again. Being single and having money was like standing 6'4" with a full head of hair. Everyone is trying to fix you up and get you lots of dates with interesting and attractive women. Nothing really clicked until Walter Wriston and his wife Kathy arranged a blind date with Jane Beasley, an attractive attorney who worked for Kathy's brother at the New York law firm Shearman & Sterling. When Jane's boss called her to ask if she would go out with Jack Welch, she thought he was talking about another lawyer at the law firm. "I can't go out with him," she said. "He's a colleague." "Not him," he said. "This Jack Welch is the chairman of General Electric, and he's a little bit older than you." "That doesn't matter. I'm not going to marry the guy." At the time, Jane was in London on an extended assignment with the firm. 6 months later, she returned, and in October 1987, we went out to dinner with the Wristons at Tino's, an Italian restaurant in New York. With Walter sitting there, the date was a little stiff. I had to be on my best behavior, but Jane and I left at 10 p.m. and went on to close the bar at Café Luxembourg. It took a second date over burgers at Smith & Walensky, both of us arriving in leather jackets and blue jeans, to really make the match. Jane is bright, tough, witty, and 17 years younger than I am. She is down to earth in every way. Jane is from a small town in Alabama. As a kid, she picked butter beans at 5:30 a.m. on her father's farm until her back ached. Her mother was a teacher, and she was a tomboy in a family with three brothers. She went to law school at the University of Kentucky and then came to New York to become a mergers and acquisitions lawyer. I wasn't always the ideal date. In the summer of 1988, I invited her to Nantucket for the weekend. She had to go through a major negotiation with her boss to get the time off. On Friday night, we went out to dinner. The next morning, I woke up, got dressed, and started to walk out the door. "Where the hell are you going?" she asked. "I'm going to play golf." "You're kidding," she said. "I had to practically sign away my birthright to get this weekend off, and you're going golfing?" I honestly didn't know any better. This is what I did when I was married. I worked hard all week, and then on Saturday morning I got dressed and went out the door to play golf with the guys. This time, I knew this routine was over. When we started to get serious, we had the "why it won't work" talk. I told her it bothered me that she didn't ski or play golf. She told me it bothered her that I didn't go to the opera. We made a deal. I agreed to go to the opera if she agreed to ski and golf. I really wanted a full-time partner. Someone who would be willing to put up with my schedule and travel with me on business trips. Jane would have to give up her career. She took a leave of absence to try it out and, luckily for me, decided to make this her full-time occupation. We got married in April 1989 at our house in Nantucket with my four kids present. For the next few years, I went to the opera, calling it husband duty, until Jane later relieved me of the obligation. While my appreciation for opera didn't grow, teaching her golf took me to a whole new level. I had been trying to win club championships for years and had never gotten anywhere. We got better together. Even though she had never played golf before meeting me, Jane won the club championship at Sankaty Head in Nantucket 4 years in a row, and I won it twice. She's become the perfect partner. Back at work, the first chip that we played in the RCA deal was the TV manufacturing business. In June 1987, Paolo Fresco and I were in Paris at the French Open, entertaining customers at this NBC telecast event. Elaine Gomez, the chairman of Thomson, France's government-owned electronics company, stopped by our hospitality suite. He was a fun and gutsy guy. We already had planned to see him at his office the following day. When we got together, it was not unlike my first meeting with Bradshaw. Both our companies had businesses that needed help. Thomson had a very weak number 4 or number 5 medical imaging business called CGR that I wanted. We had a number 1 U.S. position in medical equipment, from X-ray devices, CT scanners, and magnetic resonance imaging machines. We had no meaningful position in France because the government's ownership of Thomson essentially closed the country to us. Elaine Gomez made it clear he had no interest in selling his medical business outright. Paolo and I decided to see if he might be interested in a trade. We always knew what businesses in our portfolio we didn't like. I jumped up and went to an easel in Thomson's conference room, grabbed a magic marker, and began to write down businesses we could swap for their medical operations. My first try was our semiconductor business. That didn't fly. Then I tried the TV manufacturing business. He liked that idea immediately. His TV business was subscale and strictly European-based. Elaine saw the trade as a way to unload his losing medical business and overnight become the number one producer of television sets in the world. The three of us got excited about this deal. We decided that Paolo Fresco would meet with one of Elaine's people to get the discussion started within a week. Elaine took us down the elevator to our car waiting outside his office. As the car pulled away from the sidewalk, I grabbed Paolo by the arm. "Holy sh—" I said. "I think he really wants to do this." We were both giddy. I'm sure Elaine went back upstairs feeling the exact same way. Elaine knew that his TV set business was too small to compete against the Japanese. The deal gave him the economies of scale and market position to mount a strong challenge. Our domestic electronics business had $3 billion in annual sales and 31,000 employees. Thomson's medical equipment business had $750 million in annual revenues. The trade would triple our market share in Europe to over 15%, giving us a presence against our biggest competitor, Siemens. Within 6 weeks, the deal was done and announced in July. Besides the swap, Thompson gave us $1 billion in cash and a patent portfolio that for 15 years threw off $100 million annually in after-tax dollars. Meanwhile, Thompson became the largest TV set producer in the world. Our move out of TVs, however, was a tough nut for many to swallow. Media critics claimed we were bowing to Japanese competition by selling out. Some attacked the deal as un-American. I even got called a chicken for running away from a fight. The criticism was media nonsense at its best. We ended up with a more global, high-tech medical business and a lot of cash. 1 year of the patent stream income was more than we had made in the previous decade in the TV set business. We both struggled in the short term. We lost money in medical in Europe for almost a decade. Thompson did the same with the consumer electronics business. We both stayed with it and ultimately made each business successful. Within 2 years, we found the solution for our semiconductor business. Harris Corporation, like us, had a subscale chip business. In July, I got a call from Harris Chairman Jack Hartley, who wanted to come to Fairfield to feel me out on buying the business. Harris was primarily a defense electronics contractor with a small semiconductor operation that mainly supported its military sales. Hartley didn't think the company could survive in semiconductors if it didn't bulk up and gain volume from the industrial side. I never liked semiconductors. The chart I drew for our board captured my feelings. The business was capital-intensive and cyclical. It had short product life cycles, and the returns from most players were historically low. Getting out of it would let us use our capital for other things like jet engines, medical equipment, and power turbines that had better returns. Fortunately, our major global competitors stayed with semiconductors. That business used large amounts of their capital and diverted a lot of their management attention. My desire to get out made a deal with Harris pretty easy. I wasn't asking for much, just a graceful exit. Over lunch, Hartley and I outlined the deal. We put on a piece of paper the 6 major deal points and gave them to our financial teams. 2 months later, by mid-September 1988, the deal was done. Harris got the GE people, the facilities, and the business, and we received $206 million in cash. It took much longer, 5 years later, to move out of aerospace. The Cold War was over. There was too much capacity chasing too little business. We concluded we had to get out. The one company that seemed to be a good fit was Martin Marietta, a pure aerospace business. In late October of 1992, I went to a business council meeting looking for Martin Marietta CEO Norm Augustine. Norm is a guy with enormous integrity. He's bright, thoughtful, and literate, a great storyteller. We had barely known each other when we met that fall in the lobby of the Homestead Resort. I suggested to him that we ought to get together to talk about what each of us was going to do with our aerospace businesses. He had been thinking along the same lines, but had been reluctant to approach us, partly fearful that we might want to buy his company. "We treasure our independence," Norm said. "While I'd love to talk to you, I don't want to do anything that would jeopardize that independence." "I promise you it won't be that kind of discussion," I replied, and suggested a private dinner soon. Within a few days, Norm came up to Fairfield. By then, our team had a deal rationale all laid out on charts. Norm sat and ate his fish while I pitched. A deal was clearly in both our interests. Martin Marietta had to get bigger. For us, a deal could give us another graceful exit, this time from a military business I didn't like. Complex, almost Byzantine government procurement rules made GE a juicy target for attorneys general looking for a corporate scalp. Over dinner, we agreed to put aside the usual tactics and lay down the non-negotiable positions of what a reasonable deal might look like. By getting right down to business and agreeing to place reasonable offers on the table, we were hoping to minimize the chances of a leak that could put Martin Marietta in play. Before Norm left, we were close enough to think a deal could be put together. We agreed to close the gap without investment bankers or outside law firms. During negotiations, Norm made 3 secret overnight trips to our offices. Martin Marietta's top 100 executives were in the middle of an off-site meeting on Captiva Island in Florida at the time. Augustine would spend his day in Captiva, grab a quick dinner, and then fly to New York to negotiate with me and Dennis Dammerman for half the night. Then, he would fly back down, sleep on the airplane, and shave and shower before turning up for his company's meeting. For 3 nights straight, until 2 or 3 a.m., that was the routine. After the third night, we had the deal's essentials sketched out on a cocktail napkin and shook hands on it. Our mutual trust accelerated the negotiation. We also agreed to control the egos of lawyers and bankers. Those outside teams often engage in food fights to prove who's smartest. I told Norm, whenever that starts, let's get on the phone and resolve it quickly. We did. Over the next 3 weeks, the deal got done. When the sale was announced on November 23, 1992, the market capitalization of each company jumped by $2 billion in the first 4 hours. From our first dinner in Fairfield to the announcement of what was then the largest deal in the history of the aerospace industry took all of 27 days. Martin Marietta couldn't raise much more than $2 billion for the $3 billion deal. So Dennis Dammerman came up with a convertible preferred stock structure that helped to fund the deal and made us owners of 25% of Martin Marietta. Now, we had a continued interest in the success of the transaction. The deal doubled the size of Martin Marietta and sparked a massive aerospace industry consolidation. 2 years later, Martin itself would merge with Lockheed. By the time we sold our Martin position in 1994, our convertible note had doubled the value of the original $3 billion deal. The Martin Marietta and Harris transactions and the Thompson trade were possible because of the chips acquired with RCA. The scale created by combining businesses in aerospace, semiconductors, and TV set manufacturing was the key. Our last RCA-related transaction didn't occur until 2001. We had put RCA's satellite business into GE Capital, where its appetite for cash could be more easily satisfied. We built a strong satellite communications company, expanding RCA's original business. We had 20 satellites and access to every cable system in the United States, reaching 48 million households. While we were the largest fixed satellite provider in the United States, the business wasn't global enough. At our long-range planning review in July 2000, GE Capital CEO Dennis Naden and his team decided we had to either expand the business by making a big acquisition or sell to or merge with an existing player. Dennis mapped out a strategy to find a partner and ultimately negotiated a deal with SES, a Luxembourg company with 22 satellites that reach 88 million households. We sold our satellite holdings to them for $5 billion, split almost equally in cash and stock. The pending deal would give us a 27% stake in the new SES group and make the entity a true global player. RCA ended up giving us a great network and station lineup with strong cable assets, a truly global medical business, a significant position in a global satellite company, and tens of billions of dollars in cash, all for an initial investment of $6.3 billion in 1985. RCA was a strategic win for GE. The emotional lift from the transaction was every bit as important. Chapter 11, The People Factory. After I became chairman, Joyce Hergenhahn was the first officer I hired from outside the company, one of a handful of officers ever brought in from the outside. She was outspoken and tough as nails, a very smart MBA who was well-schooled in hard knocks. She had been Con Edison's senior vice president for public affairs at a time when the utility was suffering power outages and generating more heat than light. Before we met, I had done a little background check and learned she was a sports trivia nut. Over dinner, for fun, I decided to throw her a high-hard one for my first question. Who played second base for the 1946 Red Sox? Bobby Doerr, she said without any hesitation. I was impressed. I was a lifelong Red Sox fan and remembered the 1946 World Series as if I were 11 years old again. I decided to press further. Right so far, but who held the ball too long? Oh, she came right back. You mean when Enos Slaughter scored from first base on a single? That's right. Johnny Pesky. Of course, I didn't hire Joyce for her baseball knowledge. She offered a lot more. Over 16 years, she helped shape GE's reputation as VP of Public Relations. She wasn't the first to get hired in an offbeat way. Almost 20 years earlier, I was in my VW on the New Jersey Turnpike when the engine blew. I got towed to a local garage where I met a German mechanic, Horst Oberst. Over the course of the next 2 days, while he was scrambling to get parts, we struck up a relationship. Impressed with his gutsy determination, I offered him a job. A week later, he was in Pittsfield on the payroll at GE Plastics. Horst worked there for 35 years, getting several promotions along the way. Finding great people happens in all kinds of ways, and I've always believed everyone you meet is another interview. In fact, GE's all about finding and building great people, no matter where they come from. I'm over the top on lots of issues, but none comes as close to the passion I have for making people GE's core competency. In this case, while it may seem contradictory, the system plays a very important role in making it all happen. For a guy who hates bureaucracy and rails against it, the rigor of our people system is what brings this whole thing to life. In a company with over 300,000 employees and 4,000 senior managers, we need more than just touchy-feely good intentions. There has to be a structure and logic so that every employee knows the rules of the game. The heart of this process is the human resource cycle, the April full-day Session C held at every major business location, the July 2-hour video conference Session C follow-up, and the November Session C2s, which confirm and finalize the actions committed to in April. That's the formal stuff. In GE, every day there's an informal, unspoken personnel review, in the lunchroom, the hallways, and in every business meeting. That intense people focus, testing everyone in a myriad of environments, defines managing at GE. In the end, that's what GE is. We build great people who then build great products and services. While we have a system with its binders and clear-cut agendas, it is by no means static. Other than the agendas, carefully prepared in advance, there's nothing neat and pretty about the way the people review process plays out. No matter what we put in our books, and we put everything in them, it's not simply the binders that count. What counts is the passion and intensity everyone brings to the table. When managers put their necks on the line for their direct reports, you learn as much about them as the people you're discussing. Sometimes we can debate for an hour over one page. Why are these sessions so intense? One word. Differentiation. In manufacturing, we try to stamp out variance. With people, variance is everything. Differentiation isn't easy. Finding a way to differentiate people across a large company has been one of the hardest things to do. Over the years, we've used all kinds of bell curves and block charts to differentiate talent. These are all grids that attempt to rank performance and potential, high, medium, low. We've also led the charge into 360-degree evaluations, which take into account the views of peers and subordinates. We loved that idea for the first few years. It helped us locate the horses' asses who kissed up and kicked down. Like anything driven by peer input, the system is capable of being gamed over the long haul. People begin saying nice things about one another so they all would come out with good ratings. The 360s are now only used in special situations. We were always groping for a better way to evaluate the organization. We eventually found one we really liked. We called it the Vitality Curve. Every year, we'd ask each of GE's businesses to rank all of their top executives. The basic concept was we forced our business leaders to differentiate their leadership. They had to identify the people in their organizations that they consider in the top 20%, the vital middle 70, and finally, the bottom 10%. If there were 20 people on the management staff, we wanted to know the 4 in the top 20 and the 2 in the bottom 10, by name, position, and compensation. the underperformers generally had to go. Making these judgments is not easy, and they are not always precise. Yes, you'll miss a few stars and a few late bloomers, but your chances of building an all-star team are improved dramatically. This is how great organizations are built. Year after year, differentiation raises the bar higher and higher and increases the overall caliber of the organization. This is a dynamic process, and no one is assured of staying in the top group forever. They have to constantly demonstrate that they deserve to be there. Differentiation comes down to sorting out the A, B, and C players. The A's are people who are filled with passion, committed to making things happen, open to ideas from anywhere, and blessed with lots of runway ahead of them. They have the ability to energize not only themselves, but everyone who comes in contact with them. They make business productive and fun at the same time. They have what we call the four E's of GE leadership: very high energy levels, the ability to energize others around common goals, the edge to make tough yes and no decisions, and finally, the ability to consistently execute and deliver on their promises. We actually started with three E's: energy, energize, and edge. When we did our first session C's appraising people based on these E's, we saw several managers with plenty of energy, the ability to energize their teams, and a lot of edge. As we went from business to business, we kept running into one or two who met the three E criteria but didn't look very good to us. Before we got home, we decided we were missing something. What these managers were lacking was the ability to deliver the numbers, so we added the fourth E, execute. That did it. In my mind, the four E's are connected by one P, passion. It's this passion, probably more than anything else, that separates the A's from the B's. The B's are the heart of the company and are critical to its operational success. We devote lots of energy toward improving B's. We want them to search every day for what they're missing to become A's. The manager's job is to help them get there. The C player is someone who can't get the job done. C's are likely to enervate rather than energize. They procrastinate rather than deliver. You can't waste time on them, although we do spend resources on their redeployment elsewhere. The vitality curve is the dynamic way we sort out A's, B's, and C's, the most important tool of the session C. Ranking employees on a 20-70-10 grid forces managers to make tough decisions. The vitality curve doesn't perfectly translate to my ABC evaluation of talent. It's possible, even likely, for A players to be in the vital 70. That's because not every A player has the ambition to go further in the organization, yet they still want to be the best at what they do. Managers who can't differentiate soon find themselves in the C category. The vitality curve must be supported by the reward system: salary increases, stock options, and promotions. The A's should be getting raises that are 2 to 3 times the size given to the B's. B's should get solid increases recognizing their contributions every year. C's must get nothing. We give A's large numbers of stock options at every grant. About 60% to 70% of the B's also get options, although the same people might not receive them at every grant. Every time we hand out a raise, give an option, or make a promotion, the vitality curve is our guide. Attached to every recommendation for a reward is the person's position on the curve. Losing an A is a sin. Love 'em, hug 'em, kiss 'em, don't lose them. We conduct postmortems on every A we lose and hold management accountable for those losses. It works. We lose less than 1% of our A's a year. This system, like any other, has its flaws. Identifying the A's is one of the treats of managing. Everyone enjoys doing that. Developing and rewarding the valuable keepers in the middle, 70%, poses little difficulty. Dealing with the bottom 10 is tougher. The first time new managers name their weakest players, they do it readily. The second year, it's more difficult. By the third year, it's war. By then, the most obvious weak performers have left the team, and many managers can't bring themselves to put anyone in the C column. They've grown to love everyone on their team. By that third year, if they have 30 people in their management group, they often can't identify a single bottom 10% player, much less three of them. Managers will play every game in the book to avoid identifying their bottom 10. Sometimes they'll sneak in people who were planning to retire that year or others who already have been told to leave the organization. Some have stuck on these lists the names of employees who are already gone. One business even went to the extreme of putting into the bottom 10 category the name of a man who had died 2 months before their review. This is hard stuff. No leader enjoys making the tough decisions. We constantly face severe resistance from even the best people in our organization. I've struggled with this problem myself and have often been guilty of not being rigorous enough. Every impulse is to look the other way. I've fought it. If a GE leader submitted bonus or stock option recommendations without identifying the bottom 10, I'd send them all back until they made differentiation real. The problem with not dealing with C's in a candid, straightforward manner really hits home later when a new manager shows up. With no emotional attachment to the team, he or she has no difficulty identifying the weakest players. The bottom 10% is quickly identified. Some think it's cruel or brutal to remove the bottom 10% of our people. It isn't. It's just the opposite. What I think is brutal and false kindness is keeping people around who aren't going to grow and prosper. There's no cruelty like waiting and telling people late in their careers that they don't belong, just when their job options are limited and they're putting their children through college or paying off big mortgages. The characterization of a vitality curve as cruel stems from false logic and is an outgrowth of a culture that practices false kindness. Why should anyone stop measuring performance when people leave college? Performance management has been a part of everyone's life from the first grade. It starts in grade school with advanced placement. Differentiation applies to football teams, cheerleading squads, and honor societies. It applies to the college admissions process when you're accepted by some schools and rejected by others. It applies at graduation when honors like summa cum laude or cum laude are added to your diploma. There's differentiation for all of us in our first 20 years. Why should it stop in the workplace where most of our waking hours are spent? Our vitality curve works because we spent over a decade building a performance culture with a candid feedback at every level. Candor and openness are the foundations of such a culture. I wouldn't want to inject a vitality curve cold turkey into an organization without a performance culture already in place. What's a typical session C like? A month before we go out into the field, the corporate executive office and Bill Connedy, our head of human resources, put together an agenda for all the major businesses to follow. The action then shifts to the units, which now have to prepare the elaborate information requested. The underlying purpose is not to win a paper war. The key objective is to show how our human resources strategy is being applied to all the major initiatives of the business. The binders, the charts, the grids may seem formidable, but the meetings themselves are built around informality, trust, emotion, and humor. Nonetheless, there is a lot at stake. This review is our most important meeting of the year. A review breaks down this way. In the morning, we talk about the organization and the people in it. At lunch, we focus on diversity. In the afternoon, we review the game-changing initiatives and the people who are leading them. The morning is where most of the heat is generated. We're talking about careers, promotions, vitality curves, the strengths and weaknesses of individuals. It's a rule of the game that every person has pluses and minuses, strengths and development needs. We spend most of our time on these needs and whether, in fact, these managers are fixable. The strengths of a manufacturing leader we recently reviewed were in delivering the results, great productivity, terrific yield improvement, strong Six Sigma. But there were glaring weaknesses, too tough on people and not open to ideas from others. After a long debate over these pluses and minuses, we all concluded that this guy ought to get a warning notice. He had to change. He was running the risk of becoming a C. Not being an open thinker would be a killer. Of course, we had our lighter moments. I challenged nearly everyone, and often in outrageous ways. The Session C binders include photographs and miniature biographies of every executive. When a photo might reveal slumping shoulders, drooping eyelids, or a hanging head, I wouldn't hesitate to point them out and say, "This guy looks half dead. He can't be any good. He's in the job for 6 or 7 years, and he hasn't gone anywhere. What the hell is going on? Why haven't you moved on him?" Obviously, every picture of an expressionless person doesn't tell the story. What I wanted was a lively discussion. I expected to hear a business leader fight for his or her people. Everyone had to come out of a Session C knowing that people were the whole ball game. The players, the national anthem, the hot dogs, the seventh inning stretch, the whole game. In March of 2001, I was in Pittsfield again for a Session C review, accompanied by our new CEO, Jeff Immelt. Going through a binder, I spotted a funny picture of one of GE Plastics' high-potential managers. "If this guy is that good, you better get him a new picture," I joked. "Someone will get the wrong impression." Later that day, I met the employee and teased him. "Geez," I said, "you don't act anything like your picture. The great job you're doing doesn't go with that photo." I think he got a kick out of it, and probably a new picture. Each of these pictures is always accompanied by a 9-square grid, like a tic-tac-toe box in which one X has been filled in to show the manager's potential and performance. The best rating is the upper left-hand square. The criteria used to place that X rely heavily on our corporate objectives, the 4 E's, as well as our critical initiatives, customer focus, e-business, and Six Sigma. Under each picture, some quick capsule comments highlight a manager's pluses and minuses. Most of these capsules are pluses, but our rules of engagement require that there be at least one negative that requires improvement. We don't allow a total whitewash. One executive has pluses such as financial pit bull, 7,000-foot runway, gets e-business. The negative, wears ambition on sleeve. We never like people more focused on the next job than the one they were doing. This could be a career killer. Another is called bright, driven, and ramping up. On the minus side, execution is still a question. Failure to deliver on commitments is, in the end, unacceptable. Behind these summaries are the backup details of accomplishments and development needs. Each employee also does his or her own assessment, which is placed on the same page as their boss's analysis. For the last several years, we've met with our diverse high potentials at lunch. Each one has been assigned a mentor from the business leadership team. I made it clear over the years that these mentoring programs had nothing to do with explaining the benefit plans. We were talking about personnel development and used the discipline of product development. In this case, the mentees were the products. The business leadership staff, their mentors, had the responsibility to develop these products. That meant either taking their mentees to the A level or finding new ones. At lunch, we had candid conversations about the program's progress. Both the mentors and mentees bought into the very tough ground rules. In our performance culture, both understood that each had a responsibility to deliver a superior product and would be measured that way. The senior leadership was being held accountable. It's working. Over 80% of the 1999 mentees have been promoted. After lunch, the sessions were devoted to the initiatives. We wanted to see who was leading them and who was on each team. We got presentations from the teams on their results against their yearly targets. We picked up the best practices from each business to take to the next. And most important, we got a great assessment of just how much horsepower was driving each initiative. We'd leave each meeting with a clear-cut to-do list, which we'd share with the businesses. 2 months later, in July, we'd revisit these priorities with a 2-hour video conference to check the progress. That same list would serve as the agenda for the Session 2 meeting in November to close the loop. Despite the rigor of this process, I was surprised by what employees told us in our annual attitude surveys. Out of 42 questions, we always got the lowest marks on this statement: "This company deals decisively with people who don't perform satisfactorily." In 2001, only 75% of GE professionals agreed with the statement, and that response was an improvement over 1999, when just over 66% agreed. The level of satisfaction on that issue contrasts sharply with exceptionally good scores across the rest of the survey. When asked if an employee's career with GE has had a favorable impact on me and my family, more than 90% of the responses were favorable. The results vividly illustrate how important differentiation is at all levels of the company and how much our employees want an even more aggressive and candid approach. During Session C at major locations, we spent at least an hour meeting with local union leaders. We wanted the local union leaders to know us, and we wanted to know them and their concerns. Our mutual respect for union leadership at every level was real and ran deep. At the national level, we fought like hell with Bill Bywater for 15 years and his successor, Ed Fire, presidents of the International Union of Electrical Workers. Once or twice a year, first Frank Doyle and for the last 7 years, Bill Connedy, our HR heads and I, would sit down with them over dinner and argue over pay, benefits, and the other typical issues. The biggest philosophical difference between us was my feeling that if we were doing our job right, our employees didn't need an organization to represent their interests. My position always drew a heated response from Bill and Ed, who objected to our resistance to their organizing efforts. Our differences were always in the open. There were no hidden agendas between us, and GE never had a major strike in more than 20 years. On the broader labor front, my predecessor, Reg Jones, had led a labor management group of about 10 labor leaders and 10 CEOs that was active with George Meany and Lane Kirkland of the AFL-CIO in the 1970s. I liked the idea a lot and shared the leadership of this group first with Lane Kirkland and then John Sweeney. John and I can both be thick-headed Irishmen, but I always felt we shared a genuine respect for each other. We've tried to get agreement on subjects like healthcare, trade, and education. While the group has been only marginally successful on policy over our many meetings, we've benefited from a better understanding of one another's positions. Our approach to dealing with labor unions was no different from the way we felt about all our employees. Many outsiders often ask me, how can the GE culture possibly work in various cultures across the world? The answer to that question was always the same. Treat people with dignity and give them voice. That's a message that translates around the globe. There weren't enough hours in a day or a year to spend on people. This meant everything to me. I'd always try to remind managers at every level that they had to share my passion. While I might be the big shot standing in front of them today, they were in fact the big shots to the people in their businesses. They had to transmit the same energy, commitment, and accountability to their people, to whom Jack Welch didn't mean a thing. My ex-wife, Carolyn, always reminded me that I worked in the company 10 years before I ever knew who was chairman. The important thing I urged every GE manager to remember was that they were the CEO as far as their people were concerned. Even our biggest and best stars know the rules. As Andy Lack, president of NBC, says, Jack and I have been friends for 8 years, and our wives see each other all the time. If I started down a path where I made 4 incredibly bad decisions, I know he would fire me. He'd hug me, say he's sorry, and maybe you won't want to go to dinner with me anymore, but he wouldn't hesitate to get rid of me. It's all about performance. Chapter 12, Remaking Crotonville to Remake GE. Change has no constituency, and a perceived revolution has even less. In early January 1981, just 2 weeks after being named chairman-elect, I was in Florida for GE's annual general management meeting. I had been going to this event at the Bellevue Biltmore in Clearwater since 1968. It was during a cocktail reception before dinner one evening that I searched out Jim Bowman. Jim was a bearded academic, a former Harvard Business School professor who had consulted for GE over the years. He had been named the head of Crotonville, our management development center, a year earlier. I found Jim mingling in a small crowd. You're just the guy I'm looking for, I said. I grabbed Jim by the arm, introduced myself, and quickly got past the small talk. I told him to get ready for the ride of his life. We're going to be making all kinds of changes in this company, and I need Crotonville to be a big part of it. Without Crotonville, I didn't think we had a prayer. I needed to communicate the rationale for change to as big an audience as I could. Crotonville was the place to do it. Crotonville, a 52-acre campus in Ossining, New York, had been at the heart of an earlier management makeover. Former CEO Ralph Cordner built the facility in the mid to late 1950s to push his decentralization idea down into the ranks. Thousands of GE managers were taught to take control of their own operations with profit and loss responsibility. For many years, the center's instructors taught a useful menu of training courses based on the Blue Books, nearly 3,500 pages of management do's and don'ts. Thousands of general managers were raised on this gospel. Back in those days, the plan, organize, integrate, measure principles spelled out in the Blue Books were like commandments. Once decentralization took hold, Crotonville was used less as a training ground for leadership development than as a forum to deliver technical training or important messages in times of crisis. During the 1970s, when escalating oil prices fueled rampant inflation, Reg sent hundreds of managers through seminars on managing in inflationary times. By 1980, the facilities had aged. Crotonville gradually became more a consolation prize than a place where the company's best gathered. The programs used open enrollment, and the quality of the attendees varied widely. Much of the company's future leadership wasn't bothering to attend. Only two of the seven contenders for Reg's job had taken the multi-week general management course. I wasn't one of them, although I remember taking a one-week marketing class in the late 1960s. I liked the course, but didn't particularly like the accommodations. By 1981, Crotonville was tired. Real tired. I wanted to bring the place to life and needed this former Harvard professor to lead the effort. I saw Crotonville as a place to spread ideas in an open give-and-take environment. It could be the perfect place to break through the hierarchy. I needed to connect with managers deep in the organization without my message being interpreted by layers of bosses. But if Crotonville was to do all this, it would have to change. Within a few weeks of meeting Jim Bowman in Florida, we were sitting together in Fairfield over a three-hour lunch wrestling with the center's future. I wanted to change everything, the students, the faculty, the content, and the physical appearance of the facilities. I wanted it focused on leadership development, not specific functional training. I wanted it to be the place to reach the hearts and minds of the company's best people, the inspirational glue that held things together as we changed. I don't want anyone to go there who doesn't have great potential, I told Jim. I want the good ones coming up, not the tired ones looking for a last reward. If we were going to ask only the best to go, we had to make Crotonville a world-class center. We had to reinvest in facilities when we were in the middle of gut-wrenching change, the restructuring of our portfolio and downsizing. We renovated the pit, the main multi-level classroom, right away and began building a helipad so our leadership team could get there and back faster. It was an hour's drive each way by car from Fairfield. I asked Jim to pitch our case to the board. He did that in June 1983 and included a request for $46 million to build a new residence center there. Jim recalls that when I reviewed his presentation, I crossed out the payback analysis on his last chart. I drew a next over the transparency and scrawled the word infinite to make the point that the returns on our investment would last forever. I meant it. It was slow going. My first session with a class of GE managers went over like so many of my early meetings. We weren't set up yet at Crotonville. The executives in a four-week management course were bussed to Fairfield for what was billed an evening with the chairman. In June 1981, I was up in front of 50 managers in our headquarters auditorium. All of us were dressed in suits and ties. The class sat in front, and the company's human resources staff sat in the back. My off-the-cuff remarks that night were based on my favorite themes, our number one and number two strategy, and my desire to change the feel of the company. After discussing where I wanted to take GE, I opened it up for questions. There were a few, but no one in the room wanted to challenge any of my thoughts. At least 70% of the people in the auditorium had that skeptical look, you know the look I mean, when people aren't with you. To be fair, I'm sure I intimidated the hell out of them. Here I was, pacing back and forth in front of the class, threatening to fix, close, or sell the very businesses they worked in, while all the people in charge of their careers sat in the back row. It had to be pretty nerve-wracking. Only the few managers frustrated with the bureaucracy liked it. I understood the confusion and fear in the room. Hell, those managers signed up for a different, more traditional GE. I was struggling to find the right words and was blurring the impact of my message. The themes of excellence, quality, entrepreneurship, ownership, facing reality, and number one and number two were overwhelming these people, who were worried about whether they would still have a GE job. I continued holding the classes at the Fairfield Auditorium, busing managers to headquarters for an evening session followed by a reception over drinks. Things gradually got better, but it was tough sledding. The company's mood fluctuated on the bullishness of our press clippings and the price of our stock. Every positive story seemed to make the organization perk up. Every downbeat article gave the whimpering cynics hope. Fortune magazine weighed in early with an upbeat assessment in January of 1982, trying to bring GE to life. Less than 6 months later, I got whacked with the neutron tag. A strong endorsement followed in Forbes magazine in March of 1984, extraordinary designs for a whole new future. I remember flying in a helicopter from Fairfield to New York with Henry Kissinger when the cover story came out. He thought the story was sensational. Coming from media-savvy Henry, that was a big deal. Any good feeling from that was gone quickly. 5 months later, Fortune was calling me the toughest boss in America. In the media, at least, I went from prince to pig and pig to prince very quickly. Fortunately, the equity market was on my side. After years of being stuck, GE stock and the market began to take off, reinforcing the idea that we were on the right track. For many years, stock options weren't worth all that much. In 1981, when I became chairman, option gains for everyone at GE totaled only $6 million. The next year, they jumped to $38 million, and then $52 million in 1985. For the first time, people at GE were starting to feel good times in their pocketbooks. The buy-in had begun. In 1984, I started going to Crotonville for every one of our top three management classes. We overhauled all of them. They had been based on case studies at other companies. We changed that to tackle real GE issues. Jim Bowman recruited an innovative University of Michigan management professor, Noel Tishy, who helped to remake the coursework. Tishy, who became head of Crotonville from 1985 to 1987, brought great passion to the job and introduced action learning. Many courses ran at Crotonville, ranging from new employee orientation to specific functional programs. There were three courses that focused on leadership: the EDC, Executive Development Course, for the highest potential managers, the BMC, Business Management Course, for mid-level managers, and the MDC, Management Development Course, for fast-trackers early in their careers. The first level of these was the three-week MDC, which ran 6 to 8 times a year. These courses, attended by 400 to 500 managers annually, were held exclusively at Crotonville in a classroom atmosphere. Tishy's action learning concept of working on real business issues became the heart of the more advanced BMC and EDC classes. Projects were focused on a key country, a major GE business, or the progress the company was making on an initiative like quality or globalization. Interestingly enough, we had BMC classes in Berlin the same day the wall came down, and in Beijing the very day of the Tiananmen Square protest. The students watched both events, but all came out safe and sound and smarter for the experience. We held three BMCs a year, with about 60 in each class, and one EDC a year for 35 to 50 of our most high-potential managers. Both these courses were 3 weeks long and were scheduled so that each class could present their recommendations in a 2-hour session at the quarterly meetings of our Corporate Executive Council. The CEC meetings bring together 35 GE executives, the CEOs of the major businesses, and the top corporate staff. These classes became so action-oriented they turned students into in-house consultants to top management. The classes looked at our opportunities for growth and how other successful companies were going after it in just about every developed and developing country in the world. They evaluated how fast and effective our four initiatives were taking hold. In every case, there were real takeaways that led to action in a GE business. Not only did we get great consulting by our best insiders who really cared, but the classes built cross-business friendships that could last a lifetime. The courses became an important recognition of achievement. No one could go to BMC without business leader approval. No one could go to EDC without approval from HR head Bill Connedy, the vice chairman, and me. All nominations for the classes were reviewed at our session C's. By the mid-1980s, the faces and the dialogue in the classrooms were improving. The makeup of these classes had changed dramatically. After we began handing out stock options to a larger number of managers in 1989, I began the entry class asking, "How many of you have received grants?" At first, less than half would usually raise their hands. Well, I have good news for everybody. For those who got options, congratulations. You wouldn't have them if you weren't A players. The stock has been strong, and with continued strong performance, you should look forward to making real money on those options. By this time, the rest of the crowd, none of whom had ever seen a stock option, were wondering what was going to come next. "And it's good news for those of you who haven't received a grant," I said. "Now you know that your boss isn't leveling with you. If your boss told you that you're a star, something's wrong, because all our stars are getting options. You should go back and talk to your manager and ask why you're not getting them." Surprisingly, many didn't, because they knew in their gut where they stood. In 1991, we decided that no one could attend Crotonville's top programs if they didn't receive a grant. All the A players should get stock options, and all should gain the experience of going to Crotonville. In 1995, I read a piece in Fortune magazine on how PepsiCo executive Roger Enrico and his team were teaching leadership to Pepsi executives. I liked the Pepsi model and decided that every member of our leadership team should teach a session. Before, our senior staff and business leaders had done it only on a sporadic basis. The Pepsi model gave the classes a close look at our most successful role models, and it gave our leadership a broader pulse of the company. Today, some 85% of the Crotonville faculty are GE leaders. By 1986, the physical overhaul of Crotonville had been completed. We had a new residence hall to go with our new classrooms, and most important, the people in the classrooms had really changed. They were more energetic and much more likely to ask challenging questions. In all, it took perhaps 10 years for most of our people to really get it. In the past decade, the pit has been filled with excited and engaged people. The faces are young and diverse. The questions are smart and challenging for me and for them. Crotonville is now an energy center, powering the exchange of ideas. When all is said and done, teaching is what I try to do for a living. Truth is, I've always liked teaching. After getting my PhD, I even interviewed at a few universities. In my first days at GE, I regularly taught math to one of my technicians, Pete Jones. During lunch hour, we'd get together in my Pittsfield office. I knew he was smart, and I wanted him to go back to school. Pete would tell you I was an impatient teacher. Sometimes I'd throw chalk at him when he failed to understand the formulas I wrote on my office blackboard. Somehow it all worked. Pete left GE and got his degree and later taught for 30 years in the Pittsfield school system. It was easy for me to get hooked on Crotonville. I spent an extraordinary amount of my time there. I was in the pit once or twice a month for up to 4 hours at a time. Over the course of 21 years, I had the chance to connect directly with nearly 18,000 GE leaders. Going there always rejuvenated me. It was one of the favorite parts of my job. Whenever I went to Crotonville, I never lectured. I loved the wide-open exchanges. The students taught me as much as I taught them. I became a facilitator, helping everyone learn from one another. I had ideas that I brought to every class, and our exchanges enriched them. I wanted everyone to push back and challenge. For the last 10 years, they have. Before I showed up, I would sometimes send ahead a handwritten memo of what I expected to cover during a session. For our MDC, I typically asked them to think as a group about some issues. "I'll be talking about A, B, and C players. I'll be asking your thoughts about the differing characteristics of each and want to engage you in a discussion about them." What are the major frustrations you deal with that I can help with? What don't you like about a career in GE that you would like to see changed? Are you experiencing the quality initiative? How would you accelerate it in your area, your business, and the company? For our EDC program, I had a different set of issues. I asked them what they'd do if they were appointed CEO of GE tomorrow. What would you do in your first 30 days? Do you have a current vision of what to do? How would you go about developing one? Present your best shot at a vision. How would you go about selling the vision?